Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. This interview is very special and personal to me because I'm going to be speaking with one of my childhood friends, Paula. We have known each other since kindergarten, and we have went to the same grammar school and high school. But after high school, she went off to Marquette University in Wisconsin, where she got her bachelor's degree. She majored in English literature with an additional major in elementary education. After returning home and starting her career with a college, she eventually opens up her own very successful school for preschool and kindergarten children. After suffering some migraines and a few panic attacks on the highway, a trip to a doctor ends her up on not only a benzodiazepine, but on an antidepressant right at the very first visit. And here we are, 40 years later, and she is now tapering. I hope you gather from our conversation how special our friendship is. And even though over the years after high school we went our separate ways, we stayed in touch. You're going to be hearing her dog Teddy barking at different points during the interview, but, you know, we didn't mind because when somebody walked by the house, he was protecting her. So we just try to keep these podcasts as real as they can be. Please stay tuned afterwards for our post-show talk. Hi, Paula. I am so glad that we're finally doing this podcast together.
I am too. We've been trying to get to this point for a long time.
Yeah. And we had scheduled it for World Benzodiazepine Awareness Day on July 11th, but you were away, so it was better to do it once you got home. And we were going to be doing it, you on your computer, us in the closet, but, you know, neither one of us are very tech savvy, so we need Garrett here. So here we are in your dining room. Just like when we were kids, mm-hmm. We've known each other a very long time since kindergarten. So I want, and Teddy's here, your dog is here, so that's fine. Yeah. So if somebody's walking by, he lets you know. So what led you to being prescribed a benzodiazepine?
When I moved back here from Wisconsin, I was having a horrible time with migraines and anxiety. I was just so on edge and stressed out all the time. And I was fortunate enough to be referred to a doctor who could help me, which initially he did, but that was 40 years ago. And it was 38 years ago when you, no, it was 2 years ago.
2 years ago.
When you picked up on the fact that I was taking a benzodiazepine and told me all of the horror stories about your experience.
But let's just to be clear, over the years, I could see, because I knew myself, that I saw changes happening in me. Mm-hmm. And since, you know, I'm now in the house I grew up in, you're now in the house you grew up in, we only live, you know, minutes from each other, and I could see a difference. And during those years, I knew never to push you. I didn't know for sure you were on something, but I could see changes happening in you that happened in me. So I was always hinting and saying things I was trying to do to help myself. But then came, I think it was a text. I woke up one morning to a text that you had now fallen for a third time and you had a concussion. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh my gosh. So now comes, I've got to take you to the doctors. And now the realization is coming in. You know, it's like no more fooling around.
Right, right.
And I think that's part of World Benzodiazepine Awareness Day. You want to make people aware, but nobody has the right to force or, you know, come on hard at somebody. We had to wait till the time was right, and the time happened to be very right two years ago.
Yeah, and I think for a long time, I mean, I knew that I was like a shadow of the person I used to be. Yeah. I knew that I wasn't happy, I wasn't fun, I wasn't funny, I just...
Your world was closing in on you?
It really was.
You weren't
avoided...
seeing friends?
No.
See things?
No, I always had an excuse why I couldn't do things, why I couldn't go places, and it was really sad.
Yeah,
because
you were...
But I didn't know why, I couldn't understand why this was happening.
And you, like me, we were very outgoing when we were younger.
Yes.
Like, you know, we grew up in this section of Boston, and... You know, we were very fortunate and, you know, we had good lives.
Yes.
We didn't abuse anything. You know,
right.
there was a little bit of drinking, but there was nothing bad.
No, and, we were just real funsters.
Yeah. And then to be given a prescription drug that mm-hmm. was more harmful than a street drug. Yeah. It's we both could tell something was changing in us. I know I asked my doctor constantly and I was told it wasn't the drugs. Mm-hmm. I think, did you ever ask your doctor?
Actually,
are you really?
I didn't, because I, you know, little goody two shoes, I did exactly what the doctor said.
Yeah.
And I went from the doctor with whom I originally met. He was wonderful, but I got a new job, which was an hour away,
right,
you know. And I moved, and I thought, I can't keep doing this. I mean, I couldn't make it back, you know,
right,
to in-town Boston and back. So I thought, well, I will switch all my medical records to a more convenient hospital. And doctors just continued prescribing this drug. They never asked any questions about the dosage, the length of time I was on it. They never did any testing. They just kept writing the prescriptions. So if the doctor was doing that, I figured, well, that's what I'm supposed to be doing.
Yeah. And so, like me, you start seeing cardiologists. Actually, you had to see an oncologist. You developed breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was seeing gastroenterologists, endocrinologists. Everybody I questioned, was it the drug, told no.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You are not questioning the drug, but you're seeing all these doctors for all these health issues.
Right.
And then friends-wise, you know, your life is closing in. I ended up leaving work. You have a very successful school. You loved children.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say one of the other things that happened was you were engaged at one point when you were younger, and the drugs have come in.
Right.
And you're changing, but you don't know why. And so what happened?
I mean, you know, there was no question. I was with this guy for the better part of 8 years. And my wedding was planned, and 3 months away from the wedding, 3 months before the wedding, I all of a sudden freaked out. I just had this mental meltdown, and I thought, I can't do this. I can't marry him. I can't go through with this. And I called it off, to realize later it was probably the biggest mistake of my life.
Yeah.
But I never could understand. I never could understand why I called my wedding off, why I told him I couldn't go through with it. And to this day, I don't know why. I mean, I know that it was the drugs,
right,
because
you weren't feeling right.
They messed up my every aspect of my life.
Did you think let's call off the wedding, maybe then I'll feel better, you know, type of thing?
I did, because at this point, I had been dealing with so much stress for so long that I thought maybe I'm just at the breaking point.
Right.
And I just need to get this off my mind, off my back, and
right,
then maybe things will start to calm down.
Right, and maybe then I'll feel better. Now, during all these years that you're on it, I mean, we'd stayed in touch over the phone, because again, I don't think we saw each other that much, because now I'm married, I've got kids, I'm crazy, I don't know what's happening to me.
Right.
And yet, and I'm trying to struggle, like, why can't I, you know, my world's closing in.
Mm-hmm.
You're on it even longer, but you were still working, but struggling.
Mm-hmm.
I remember you saying you just worked.
Right.
You know, so the original doctor at the big Boston hospital who originally gave you the medication, but then you moved and switched to another doctor, he ends up at the point now when I want to come off running a benzodiazepine discontinuance clinic there. But because he did only Xanax and Klonopin, he didn't take me. But him and I talked later on. He said, I would have taken you, Geraldine. But really all they did was taper you at a pace that they set, not at a pace for the person. But he has now moved to a Chicago hospital, from what I understand. They're they're pretty aware of benzos. And I believe because of the You're Not Alone Jonathan Wagner Foundation, Debbie Wagner, who I did a podcast with, they send out all kinds of information. And that hospital he is with, they are very informed now. So they've done a lot of good work with that foundation. But you wonder, you know, what would he have done if you had stayed with him? Would he have eventually taken you off? But at no point did any doctor say, you've been on too long, let's change your diet, let's do some therapy.
Right.
A young girl left on, so one of the questions I'm going to ask you, because we've talked about this, my menstrual periods were perfect till I was given Ativan. And then, you know, the bleeding longer and longer and longer. So I end up with a hysterectomy at 41. And you had the same thing. And what happens to you from being on them so long?
I did. It was really horrendous. I fell into a pattern where I was having a DNC like every 10 months. And the doctor finally said to me, he was the chief of gynecology, and he said, we can't continue. We just can't continue doing this. It's not healthy. It's not normal. And he said, but neither is, you know, going through this 21, 23 days a month and the pain.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he wanted me to seriously consider a hysterectomy. And I just was not willing to do that. I mean, I really wanted to have children, and I thought, I'll just put up with it then.
Right.
And then I ended up anemic, and I mean, I'd be sitting at work or at school, and mm-hmm. I would pass out. I mean, it was horrible. Yeah. It was a horrible, horrible yeah. thing.
And yet, but, you know, an article came out 1 year after these drugs hit the market showing the effect it has on a woman's menstrual cycle, and no one's paying attention. The first year we spoke in at the State House, I would say just about every woman there, so I, you know, had either hysterectomy, they were bleeding constantly and had DNCs, or you can lose your period. So there were a couple of girls there who had lost their periods. And then once they tapered off, one girl actually, she got hers back in 13 months, but I know one of the other girls who didn't come, it took her 3 years to get hers back. She was able to have one child. She, you know, and that was it. She's struggle hasn't been able to have another child. So when you take young girls and you're putting them on these drugs and just keeping them on the long term, not only did you miss out on your marriage and you missed out on having a child, which you absolutely love children. That is
right.
Your passion.
Right.
So it's just, you know, I can't even imagine, you know, what so many women go through all these years, not knowing really what's wrong with them. So, you know, one of the other things is, so socially now you're not seeing people. So mm-hmm. life is now becoming, you move back home, you gave up your school. What happened then? What was the decision to give up your school?
What had happened at that point, I had recently lost my mom, and my dad was alone. And I was starting to question all sorts of things. I worried about him. It just made me very sad. And I wasn't feeling well. I never really felt well. I felt drained all the time. And I worked a minimum of 60 hours a week. Mm-hmm. And when you're in charge, mm-hmm. You're responsible for a house full of little children, you've got to be on 60 yeah. seconds out of every minute. And I was starting to just feel so zapped.
Yeah.
And then out of the blue, I was diagnosed with breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctor said, you really need to be closer to some family. And I tried to keep going. I tried to keep going after I started treatment. And I just couldn't do it. I was crashing. Yeah. And prior to that point, I had given up, you know, any idea of going out and socializing or going on a date or anything, because mm-hmm. I just needed all my energy for work.
Right.
That was my entire life.
Yeah.
And
now let's mention, when you were put on the Klonopin, and, you know, you're a tiny person. Of all of us growing up, you were like this tiny little person, and you were put on 3 milligrams right up the front, not a half a milligram, not a milligram, 3 milligrams. That's a lot. Nobody even thought twice about that. But you're also given an antidepressant, and they're not questioning, you know, nothing. Nothing's being questioned. So now you move home. You're back home. You have breast cancer. Your father's sick. So at least you had that safety bubble, you know. Mm-hmm. And I know I kept trying to call. Like I said, I instinctively knew. I'm like, I bet she's on them too, like me. I could see, mm-hmm. you know, but we didn't lose touch. But because now I had my times, I couldn't leave the house either to
yeah.
come down. So, but now you're at a point, the concussions are happening. So now, you know, your father passed away. You're now, you have the house, you're in the house. And how is your family during all this? They still don't know. So the discovery doesn't come till when you have the concussions.
Right.
And then I've got to take you to the doctor's because you can't drive. So we're going to doctors. And I remember we went to one neurologist. No. And I bring the Ashton manual and I'm talking to her about the Klonopin. And she said, oh, no, you know, that wouldn't do anything to her. I thought, oh, we are never coming back here again.
Yeah. She did not want to hear.
She didn't want to hear anything. Nothing. No. So they like totally don't talk to me about it. Like, then we went to another neurologist at a different Boston hospital. He was great because he actually knew. And you also had a wonderful PCP at the time. She also, when we talked, and you know, we said, you know, he had the Ashton manual. I said, I think this is why she's having all these problems, and she agreed. And she gave us carte blanche to help. She said, I don't know how to get her off. You know, and that is the big problem. They don't know how to take people off. So you now have found a wonderful psychiatrist, you know, which is, and he's explained what to you about as far as, because you're having memory issues, and I know you're very afraid of a dementia type of thing, because your mom had dementia.
Right.
But you've been on now, it's 40 years. So what has he explained to you about, you know, what the benzos and the antidepressants have done to you after all 40 years?
Well, at the time I first met with this psychiatrist who does specialize in addiction. And
we're not addicts, right? We were good patients, but that's his specialty, which I'm surprised he's being so slow with you.
Yeah,
so he's being really excellent with you, microtaper.
Yeah, very, very slow. And I don't know if it was at the same time I was seeing this psychiatrist. I think he was the one who thought that I might benefit from seeing a neuropsychologist. And I went into Boston and met with this neuropsychologist. He was wonderful. And he did all sorts of tests. And then he also had me go through all sorts of exercises. You know, like copying, you know, with a pen and paper and drawing pictures and copying things and everything. And I was in such a panic doing this because I thought, oh my God, I one of my former students could do this and I can't cope. I can't do these simple tasks. And based on the results of those tests and the MRIs and scans and everything else, he said that my brain was altered, that I had suffered cognitive impairment due to the long-term use of these drugs.
How did you feel when is there anger that here we are in Boston, I got terrible treatment. I couldn't get one doctor to say it was a problem, so I had to do it all on my own. Are you angry at this point? Like what? What happens?
My real reaction was fear. Fear and just overwhelming sadness. You know, what happened in my life?
Yeah.
You know, I was, as you said earlier, very social. I loved being out and about with people. I was very proud of my work. I worked really hard.
Very smart.
And I thought, this is where I am at this point in my life. I can't carry a thought for more than seconds. And I was terrified. And I said, am I going to regain my memory? Am I going to be able to think again as I once did? And he was very kind. And he said, I don't want to discourage you, Paula, but he said, it will come back, you know, your memory will come back, but it's not going to happen quickly. He said, it took you almost 40 years to get to this point, so you can't expect that things are going to return to normal for you. And given my age, I mean, it probably never will at this point.
No, but we're gonna be out doing stuff. We're going to, you know, I know a couple of years ago when all this started, I'm like, okay, I'm going to be here for you. We're going to do stuff. I was cooking and bringing stuff down. And then Joe got sick. So life took a turn there and I felt terrible that we weren't doing more because I think socialization is really important. So here's a question I want to ask you. Do you wish during the years, you know, because it's over 20 years I've known, you know, about me, that I was more pushy with you, that I came right full force and asked you, or you had to wait till you were ready to, till the concussions came? And
you know, actually, no, I can't say that I wished that you were pushy, because we've been friends for so long. I respected the fact that you knew I was struggling.
Mm-hmm.
And you watched out for me. I don't want to get
emotional.
You have saved me.
Yeah, I can't keep crying during these podcasts.
You're the only person who never gave up on me.
Right.
You kept calling.
Because I've been there.
You kept checking on me.
Right. Like, I knew when I was having, so as I started to get better, every Christmas I would have, because I still couldn't go out, I would have this big, elaborate Christmas thing at my house with all of us that grew up together. And I did all the cooking, you know, so it had a theme every year, and I invited you every year and you didn't come. And I knew, but I'm like, I'm going to keep inviting her. And, you know, and one of the other girls, again, there were one, two, four of us that all got drugged when we were younger, and one has now passed away. And the other one is off of the benzos occasionally and still on the antidepressant. And again, I've never given up on her. You know, it's like I call or stop down. We all grew up in the same neighborhood, because unless you've been there, you don't know.
Yeah.
So now here's, like, your family wondered probably what was wrong with you all those years.
Right.
And again, very loving.
Mm-hmm.
But then when now we know for sure what's right. going on. So I contacted two of your sisters, had mm-hmm. conversations with them, and, you know, really tried to. And then they were doing some research on their own. So mm-hmm. they then got it, what happened to you.
Right.
But I think, like any of us, when I say my family was supportive, and your family supportive, but they think you're going to get over it. And like, right. oh, well, why isn't she off the drugs by now? Why aren't I healed by now?
Right.
This is a, you have to come off very slowly.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they're good, but like anybody, if a doctor doesn't get it, how are our families supposed to
right.
get it?
Right, exactly.
You know, but they did their research. So I think, you know, got to give them, good credit for looking it up, but still not, I don't think unless somebody goes through it, they get it fully,
No, absolutely not.
Yeah, mm-hmm. but great. You have a great family, you know.
I am blessed.
Yeah, you really are, and they're there for you. So, I mean, you know, we want people to realize why we're doing this. If you have a friend that isn't acting like you used to know them, I mean, make a phone call. You don't have to say, "Hey, are you on benzos?" Because
right.
you seem to be. Because I never said that to you.
Are you
crazy too? Yeah, you were not like me. And we laugh about it. And I think we laugh about it. I mean, what are we going to sit here and cry every day
right.
about what we have lost?
Right.
You can't, because, you know, every day has to be positive.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've been through it, turn around and help another person. But
right.
I'm sure anybody listening to this, you're going to look at friends and think, wow, you know what? They started to, like, kind of, you know, stay in the house more, or they always have an excuse. Just stay friends with them. Don't get angry and say, mm-hmm. oh, well, they never call. I'm not going to call them anymore, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Make a phone call.
Yeah.
And I think that that's really, really important, you know? So, I mean, who would have thought this is where our lives went? But, you know, we're both committed to helping others. You know, even though you're coming off now, you're very encouraged. So I want to mention this. So support groups online, they can be wonderful, especially when people don't mm-hmm. have anybody. But I remember I said to you, okay, you're informed now. You've got all the information. I don't want you on the support groups. I don't want you to see all the negativity. You did go on a few times, and you were like, oh
God,
like,
it was awful. It was terrifying.
Terrifying. That's right. And you don't want to carry anybody else's stress. So again, I think it's great to have it. But, you know, years ago, we would put success stories on there, because
mm-hmm.
that's what I wanted when I started the support group. Success stories is what gave me hope that I could get off and recover.
Right.
So it's like, so then I'm like, just don't go on. You're very positive. You're out walking with Teddy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'll be going back up to New Hampshire to your sisters. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, you're by the water. Just everything relaxing and calm and away from the stress. And there are people that, you know, you see them writing trigger because they're going to write something terrible. And I know they need to share that, because
mm-hmm.
they might not have anybody they can
right.
say to. It have your benzo friends. So mm-hmm. right now, I'm your benzo friend.
Benzo buddy.
Yeah, my benzo buddy. Because, mm-hmm. you know, this, I don't think you really need anybody else right now.
I mean,
our childhood friends.
I mean, you know everything about me.
Right.
I mean, We go back to when we were 5 years old.
Yeah. So,
I don't know. Yeah. As long as I have you, I don't.
Right. And it's just, you want to run it by. And again, you have the one thing a lot of us don't have, and that is a really good doctor in your corner.
Yes.
Who is absolutely not going to force you. He understands what you're going through. And if there are any medical professionals listening to this, hear how important that is for her to have. I mean, all of us should have that, you know?
What a lifesaver.
Yeah.
I know. I called you after I met with him, and I said, oh my God, he is so kind.
Yeah.
And soft-spoken and understanding. Mm-hmm. And I was so happy when I left that man's office. Yeah. I mean, he was wonderful.
Right. So even though it's been 2 years since the discovery, because now we're at 40 years on, I mean, I think cognitively you're still a little better. Yes, you do have some memory issues, but, you know, back then you had the concussions, you weren't driving. You're driving now. Look at you can drive up to New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. I know you have your little problem on the highway. I still have a problem on the highway. I can drive if somebody's with me, but it just scares me to be alone because it reminds me of years ago, and I have to get over that trauma. To me, that is a trauma that I just never take the time for me, and I am going to, I always say I'm going to work on it, and I haven't. But if you... We're going to say something to somebody, two things, somebody who wanted to start taking a benzodiazepine and then somebody who's on them long term and trying to make a decision to come off. What would you say to them?
I would say if any doctor raises the issue of putting you on medication for anything, your first question should be, is this a benzodiazepine? No, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
No, if there's any alternative, I will consider that, but I mm-hmm. will not go near a benzodiazepine.
Yeah.
It's
for the quick fix. You're going to pay in the long run.
Absolutely. It just is. It's nothing is worth it.
Yeah.
Nothing is worth it to lose the essence of your own being. I mean, to lose who you've always been and life as you knew it. It just is not.
And we struggle. It's like I always say, where's the Academy Award? Where's the Oscar for pretending? I mean, I fought for all those years while I was on them. Oh, wait a minute. I got to act normal, or I got to come up with an excuse why I can't do this. Like, and now I'm free from all of that, thank God, except for if I had to get on the highway and drive by myself, which, again, I can drive in town now. I can do different things because I slowly did it. I just haven't taken the time because when Joe got sick, I was doing all the driving. Oh, and then as soon as he started getting a little better, he's like, no, you're not driving anymore. And I'm like, you know, you're taking that away from me. We're together too much.
Yeah.
So.
That absolutely, for me, was one of the worst things when I did live an hour away.
Mm-hmm.
And I always, because at that point in time, of the three siblings and myself, I was the closest to home. And I don't know why I thought that I was so fabulous that my parents wouldn't be able to live a weekend without seeing me.
Right.
But I would come home practically every weekend.
Yeah.
Never leave the house, but
right.
And then I reached the point where I just could not do it, and it broke my heart.
Yeah,
because I thought I'm lying to my family.
Right.
You know, everybody would gonna be getting together and to do something, and I always had an excuse.
Right. Yeah.
And I felt
we should write a book of excuses.
I know.
Just to make it easy for people.
I know.
But I remember one of the things you said as we would talk. You know. When you started to say you had some anxiety and was still, you know, I never said, what are you on? That you said it always happened at the same place on the highway,
yes.
The exact same place.
And
you know?
Do you know what? When I was driving home from New Hampshire last night, it happened again at the same exit.
Yeah. But
Washington
I said, call me.
Street in Winchester.
Right. But, you know, it's when I was taking benzos, I could not be in a line. I couldn't, or even when I was recovering, couldn't stand in line. I couldn't go to the deli counter. I mean, there was so many things I couldn't. Like, it would connect me to that. Now it's like I'm in Roach Brothers almost every day or up to Whole Foods.
Mm-hmm.
I love to walk around and, you know, it's like because I forced myself to get over that, which is why I know I can easily get over the highway thing if I just take the time. But, you know, you get up in the morning, life just starts the minute you get up.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, we just really want people to know about stay in touch with your friends. Don't ever force somebody off. This is part of our legislation here. Nobody should be forced off their benzo. It has to be when they're ready. Stay in touch with your friends. I don't care if they're not calling you. You call them. What does it take to call somebody, you know, and be a friend? If you're a real friend, you call them. It never bothered me that you weren't calling me because, again, I kind of knew. Well, what are you going to do? Hey, let's get together. I would have made up an excuse that I couldn't go.
Exactly. I was afraid. Like, what if she asked me to come over? What if she asked me to go out? I mean, yeah.
And we're both struggling. And then, you know, with the other one that we grew up with, again, I knew what was happening with her. So that was very open between her and I because we'd both had kids and she got put on meds after having a child. I got put on meds after having a child. And, you know, in her family, you know, they just think, oh, well, she's crazy. And I said, you're not crazy. Oh. It's the drugs that did it to you, you know? Mm-hmm. And she has fought hard for what she does. So be a friend. If that's the one thing out of this is be a friend and, you know, and just be there for somebody no matter where they are. And I know you're going to get better. I know each year, the lower you get. And we're not talking about your tapering except for that it's a micro taper. And because your memory, you don't even remember sometimes where you are in the taper, but it's at your own pace. And that's what the doctor is doing. So there isn't, if somebody said, oh, well, how is she doing it after 40 years? It's at your pace and working with your doctor. And that's how slow it's going to go.
All right,
Paula. Well, thank you for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. It was fun doing it with you. Not a fun topic,
but a topic that has to be talked about.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And we hope that others will, you know, let your friends listen to this. If you're struggling, have one of your childhood friends listen to this and let them come back into your life. All right. Thank you, Paula. Garrett, we are now home. We've left Paula's pretty dining room and we're back home up here in this closet. Back to the home studio in our closet, my closet. Or we should call it Dad's closet. Yeah. What did you think of the interview with Paula? Because her and I are technologically not good, we had to go down to the house to do it. So you actually got to see her while we're doing it. And at one point it got very emotional.
It did. And so I think that's the benefit of doing it in person. It's, you did get personal for a minute, and so you lose. The trade-off is, the software that we have makes it great to record over the computer with somebody, even if they were next door. I would say let's do it on our own computers, not in person.
Mm-hmm.
But with this, it's face-to-face, so it sounds like more of a real conversation. So I thought the interview was really good.
Yeah, and I'm glad we did it. And, you know, we did want to put it out on WBAD for July 11th, but because she was up in New Hampshire and she didn't have her laptop, this actually worked out much better that we did it today while she had to come home for a little bit. But I think one of the things I want people to take away from is that I changed during the years I was on it. I knew I was changing. She knew she was changing. But we had different approaches. So I had a way of staying in touch with all my friends, but had a lot of excuses why I couldn't go out. And she felt she couldn't call a lot of people because she was changing and had to make excuses. But I always was hounding her, you know, calling her. But hey, I knew I couldn't go out with her. But we stayed on the phone. Phone relationships are very important.
Did you know the entire time that she was on benzodiazepines or you were just concerned for her health?
I suspected it. Because, again, you know, here we were all, you know.
Suspected it because you knew what your symptoms were?
Right. I could see her changing. I knew when we were younger, this was an outgoing, energetic, just a fun girl to be around. I had actually, the night before my father died, back in 1974, she was here in this house with her boyfriend at the time that she then became engaged to. She had this wonderful life. And next thing you know, I was talking one time. She's like, oh, yeah, we broke up. Little things. Life's changing. Now, I'm not on benzos at that time, but I see changes in her. I am picking up on it. Until now, I think when I'm 33, when I'm put on benzos, and I immediately see that I'm changing. Now I'm thinking, is she on them too? But I never came out and asked her. But as I was trying to, you know, fight what was wrong with me, I was doing all kinds of things, I would tell her what was happening. And I would say, you know, I'm taking this Ativan in the hopes that maybe she'd say something to me, but she never did. You know, so I suspected it, and I thought, the fact that I'm suspecting it, I'm not giving up on her.
So do you think that's something worth talking about, too, that the two of you kind of had different approaches to how you would show the world whether you're on them or not, right? So everybody in your life kind of knew right away. You explained to them what's going on.
But they knew something was wrong, but we still didn't know it was the pills. You're talking 10 years. I questioned every doctor. They all told me it's not the pills. It's me. Oh, well, you've developed this. Well, I was fine, and now I'm this way. You got to remember, all I did was have a baby, and I had infection after that. And they just keep convincing you. And you can't get off of them because now you're going to be sicker, and that's when they start telling you it's you. So,
but even down the road, when you did start to figure out what was wrong with you,
I told all my friends.
You told all your friends.
I told them all.
And Paula, you'll know better than I do. Was she like that? And once she figured it out?
Well, she just she accepted it a couple of years ago. And that's when the concussion, like the last fall. And then she needed help getting to the doctors, or we'd go to the store together. I'd have to drive her. And, you know, we were starting to do a lot of things together again. And, you know, and then when Dad got sick, you know, I said to her, I'm going to be here for you. We're going to do this together. And then unfortunately, Dad got sick. And then she felt terrible, like she didn't want to bug me. But on the other hand, I could have used that little relief. I mean, her and I get along very well. Very well. And so you need laughter. And you saw that during this, that we still joke about what happened to our, you know, what happened to us. You have to laugh. It's kind of like Dad with cancer. I think what's gotten us through that is we've laughed a lot. Even his doctors will laugh with us, but they can't even believe we're laughing half the time. But it's being a friend and family. Her family, she has a wonderful family, you know, but even as supportive as my family, you know, our family has been, I know people don't understand how long it takes to get off these and get better.
Right. So it was serendipitous that you happened to be our good friend, because maybe without you, she never gets to the point where she is now.
Right. So maybe, again, what if I wasn't on benzos? Would I still have been that good friend? I would hope so, because before I got drugged, I always stayed in touch with her. So I would hope that it would have continued. So we did take two different routes. I did tell all of our other childhood friends. They all knew. There wasn't one who didn't. And hers was secluded, and she kept that a secret. And I don't think so much a secret as she just thought she was being a good patient. She needed the medication. Right. So that's another problem that we see.
So I think that brings us to kind of the next thing that we talked about a little bit after the interview ended. And it's kind of how the people in your life treat you once they know what's going on with you. And I felt like when I was younger, I always heard people call and like leave you voicemails, and it would be like, where are you? You're always home. How come you're not home when I'm calling? You're a crazy person. You're locked in the house. And like, nobody would say it maliciously.
Right. It was kidding.
It was kidding, but it wasn't either.
It was hurtful.
They expected you to be home because they just know you as the person who's locked in their house.
Yeah, I was so agoraphobic, right.
Yeah, and so it is strange the way people will react to that kind of a thing.
Right. You know, kindness gets you a lot further. And I know nobody meant it, because I was always home. You could always count on me being here to answer the phone, because I wasn't leaving, you know. And now that they call and I'm never home. You know, so don't call my cell phone when out, because I'm out, you know.
Right.
You know, I'm so glad we did this. And I just, if you're out there, if you're a medical professional, listen to the destruction in a young girl's life. So she never got married. She never had children. She loves kids. I mean, you know, now we're all in our mid-60s. And so that's a lost opportunity. But I know in my heart she's going to do this wonderful slow taper. She's getting better with her diet, because that was not one of her fortes, which is why I was cooking and bringing stuff down to her in the very beginning. And then Dad got sick. And but don't give up on friends. If you're a medical professional, listen to the destruction in our lives. Help people to get off. Understand what they're going through. If you see their life changing, it isn't that they're getting sicker. The drugs are making them sicker. Right.
And I think we should probably talk about, too, how isolating, you know, coming off of benzodiazepines can be, and that, you know, friendship, community, the whole thing is important, which is, you know, something that we always talked about when we were doing the, starting the podcast. It's, we're giving people an opportunity to kind of have a little community here and surround the podcast, which we've started to do. And it, maybe you want to talk about some of the numbers that we've been doing lately with different episodes.
Well, I'm going to leave that to you. I can do, because I can look at YouTube, but we all know I'm not good on the computer. But you had told me that we hit the top 10 in our category, which was great.
For the first time. So top 10 in our in our category, and then top 500 overall.
Yeah, and there's a lot of podcasts out, right?
And surprisingly, you know, more and more of an international audience, too. We have everything from Ireland to Russia, Spain. And then, you know, most of our audience is the U.S. and Canada.
But... Yeah. And which are the two countries that we see the most people in these groups, the U.S. and Canada, which Professor Ashton used to say she never saw the likes of the multi-drugging coming out of these two countries. Yeah. It's a shame. I don't know when it's going to change. You know, we've worked hard here in Massachusetts specifically, but hey. Anything else you want to talk about? Because I want to bring up Josh Fitzmaurice's Slick Shades, you know, one more
let's
time.
Let's talk about your new shades again.
I got my new shades. I love them. And so I just want to remind people, and I know with benzo people, a lot of them can't work or they're on disability. So if you have friends or family, Josh's company, Slick Shades, SlickShades.com. Anything on his site, if you buy something from that site and use the code word warrior, WARRIOR, basically you're going to get a 20% discount, and that goes towards supporting the benzo cause. And I am telling you, I've never just bought sunglasses because I do wear prescription glasses, and I think I'm going to keep them without a prescription in it. And I love them. I love the inscription that came inside the on the side pieces. I love the personal note. I love the case. I also got a soft case. I mean, the whole thing, and that he developed this while he was sick from benzo. So listen to his podcast, which is, what number is his? Is it 21?
21 or 22.
Yeah.
I forget. But they're definitely, so this is the first time I've seen them in person. I've only ever seen them online.
Yeah.
They're definitely the kind of sunglasses that people will ask you what they are. You can notice that they're different. Like, they're not just your run-of-the-mill, like, Ray-Ban or something like that.
No, they're beautiful.
They definitely look different, and they look handcrafted. And
yeah, he's episode 21. I just looked it up. Well, even when I wore them down to Paula's house, she's like, wow, those are really nice. Of course, your sister was waiting for them to come in, and she's like, oh, shoot, they look good on you, Mom. You know, I guess I can't take them from you. So I'm like, yeah, go buy your own pair. So
and people can check your photo that you posted on Facebook,
and they
you,
can
in
check
your new
in my shades. In my new shades. I couldn't wait. I was tracking them. I ordered them on a Monday. They came 2 days later.
We should explain too, since we just said we have an international audience now, what Cape Cod is, because I think if you're not from Massachusetts or you're not from the East Coast, maybe you don't know where they're located and what the kind of Cape Cod's all about.
So, I mean, Cape Cod is actually pretty famous here in Massachusetts. You know, you have Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket, but Cape Cod is that part that goes out in Massachusetts. Very, what do you want to say, type of towns down there. I mean, just very summery.
It's like a summer beach community that, you know, it's a tourist attraction in the summer, but it definitely has its own aesthetic. And there are other brands that have come out of that, like Cape Shark and everything, that have become big brands, and it seems like Slick could be another one that comes out.
But
soon.
His stuff, it just, everything about the company, you know, is giving back. And I just want to see people just please spread the word about his company. And it also helps the benzo cause. So I think it was a great show. So again, people, if you have friends, or even if you're the injured one, let somebody listen to this. If you have friends that have shunned you because you don't stay talking to them because you're sick, have them listen to this episode, because maybe then they'll understand. You know, I always can remember people saying to me, well, I'm not going to call so-and-so anymore. She doesn't call me, or he doesn't call me. Did you ever think maybe they were sick, and how are they going to call you? Because they can't say, let's go out, let's do something. They're sick. So their whole life right now, until they're better, is in their home. You can open up their world with a phone call. All right, Garrett.
And thank you to Teddy the dog for
Contribution to the episode. He is adorable. And that's how, you know, Teddy right now is very important to her because she does go out for her walks with him and she's got him to take care of. So Teddy's very important in her life right now. All right, Garrett, thank you again for helping to do all this because I couldn't do it without you.
You got it.